We're back. It's a distraction. I'm Drew. That's Roth. Hey, diddly ho, Roth.
Howdy, neighbor. How's it going?
I'm doing good. By the way, there's a story I forgot to tell you last week that I'm going to tell you right now. And it doesn't.
This better be about a medical emergency.
And no, I was going to say it does not involve me injuring myself in a stupid way. So good. I think that's quite. So anyway, I went skiing 2 weekends ago. I go up in the lift the first time with my friends, and we get off the lift, and my best friend Howard, like, we're all standing, you know, at the top of the lift, being like, oh, which trail do we go down, all that, and before we take off, Howard says, Drew, you gotta say we're back to everybody. And I was like, oh, all right. So I'm standing at the top of Big Sky, and I go, we're back. And then everyone laughs, and then we go down. So I thought that was a nice little story.
That's nice. A little fan service at 8,500 feet or whatever your elevation was. That's
actually solid. I went to the tippy top of Big Sky. I went up in the – they have a tram all the way up to what's called Lone Peak, and it's 11,000 feet. And you can ski down if you are a fucking maniac.
Yeah.
Or you can take the Sky Tram back down. And I took it back down, and quite quickly, I got to the top of there, and I was like
– yeah, we're good.
Like, yeah, perfect. Yeah. Like, I'm the sort of person where if I went, I was like, I would like to think I could climb Mount Everest if I had a Sherpa and, you know, they carried me in a litter and stuff like that. But like, once I was at the top of this particular mountain, which is a third of Everest size, I was like, no, I would never survive up here.
Can't. I like a tram ride. We took one in Palm Springs to the top of a mountain. And it was one of those things where if someone had told me that the tram had been built in the last like 10 years, you know, like with AI assistance and like Tesla technology or whatever, I just would not have gotten on it. But it was old enough that it was like from a time when like the United States made things that did not break by design or like, you know, make you pay, like stop halfway through and be like, $75 will help you finish this ride. And it was fine.
In tram purchases.
Yeah, I'm not a great heights guy, but it was the sort of thing where knowing that it was Eisenhower-era tech, I was like, all right, fuck, well, at least I'm not going to die getting up there or getting back. Whatever happens on top of the mountain is, you know, will be.
I'm somewhat of an acrophobe, too, and I was, you know, I was by the window of the tram, and I looked down, and I was like, oh, that was a mistake. And then it bounced a little bit, mm-hmm. Like, because it's on a rope.
Going over the towers? We love that part.
No, because you're like, and you're dangling, you know, hundreds of feet over just absolute death cliffs, like real into thin air shit. And so like when it sways in the breeze, I was like, yep. I think I want hot cocoa now.
Yeah.
Hey, let's get to the guest. It's America's favorite podcast guest. It's Rohan Nadkarni again. Hi.
Hi, Rohan. How are you with heights?
I'm pretty chill with heights. I've been skydiving before.
Wow.
My aunt used to live in one of the tallest buildings in Asia. And I was just telling a friend about how we used to go, my brother and I used to go to the top floor and just look down the stairwell. That was always a lot of fun.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, was it like a center stairwell? Like in a,
yes,
like in an action like, movie where like it the was gunmen's? Like,
yes. It was like a spiral staircase, but it was a square, if that makes sense.
What building is this? Are we talking about like the Petronas Towers? What are we talking about here?
It's called Ushakaran is the name. I mean, it used to be quite tall, but now obviously, you know, Asia since eclipse. We're talking like late 90s, early 2000s. It was up there.
Before Dubai got in the building obnoxiously tall yeah, buildings
exactly.
game.
Can I just...
I just want to know what city it was before you talk.
Mumbai.
Okay.
Drew's just picturing skylines in his head. He's like, I gotta know.
Yeah.
He's like,
is it the Burj?
Yeah. Why is Drew's like, it's like he hit enhance. It's like he's like in the control truck and he hit enhance on his camera because it's so zoomed in for some reason this time. And
oh,
I feel
really?
Like we're getting so much more forehead than normal, at least on my Zoom presentation.
That's
it's
where
a lot of
comes
the top
from.
Half.
What about
Drew's
that? Did that work?
It's still so close to your body in a way that it's not normally, but it's fine. Do what makes you comfortable.
Is it the phenomenon where like you take a screenshot of your TV and you're a little high, so then like Eli Manning's forehead like all of a sudden turns
kind of looks like the like triples great great eyes. Gazoo or whatever. Yeah, okay. It is 100%.
It just looks like you're really pressed up on the camera in a way that I'm not accustomed to.
You know what?
To.
Let's roll with it because
yeah.
Just pretend that I'm larger than life. Because
the one that I miss of all the Drew, because Ron, you've been here in like basically every iteration of this podcast where we've had guests from outside the Imperium. The version of Drew I think you were here for this, where he had the handheld mic and was just walking around the room like he was doing crowd work is the one that I love the most.
He's kind of just the
energy of him being like, what else? Yes. What else? New York's a lot different from LA. And you're like, well, no, come back. Come back to me.
There was certainly a kineticism there.
I'm wary now because, you know, Pat McAfee has sort of taken the lead as the number one standing podcaster.
I'm standing up. You're standing up.
All right. Do I have to wear like a blank, like a black beater and like be sweating all the time and be like very extremely tan and be like, whoa.
Something you should know about that is that if you have to do that, then I'm in the AJ Hawk role, which I did not consent to. That is not anything like what I signed up for.
Actually, that's a fun fact that the people don't know is that AJ Hawk has always been the third co-host of this podcast and has been for years.
He's just never talked.
Yeah.
The bit that Sammer wrote about AJ Hawk, where he's like a non-playing character in a video game, just kind of like idly heaving, waiting to send you off on a side quest or be like, guards, is a very, that's, I'll never
AJ
think of
Hawk
any other way.
Is like the NPC that's like waiting for you to solve the puzzle, and every 12 minutes will be like, try again. or not that Ruby, like, just
Ron. Since we last had you on, the Arena Group laid off everyone at Sports Illustrated after defaulting on a license fee that
fairly
they owed
hard pivot
to the Authentic Brands Group, which owns the publication. It's finally a chance for you to talk. We haven't been able to talk about it for a lot of reasons, but you can finally talk at some length about it. So I know you're a bit freer to talk about it now than you once were. So can you tell us, you know, as much as you are, you know, can tell us what's going on over there?
For sure. First of all, let me just establish that I'm speaking from my own personal experience here. In no way do I want to comment on behalf of the Sports Illustrated Union. That would be terrible.
The opinions of Rohan Nadkarni do not reflect the opinions of Authentic Brands Group.
Precisely. They reflect only my opinions. I think that, you know, for people who are like genuinely curious what's going on, if they want to follow our union Twitter account, SI Union, we're also on Blue Sky and Threads. Like, there's a lot of good information there for people who are really kind of like interested in what's going on. But just to give people the broad strokes, as you mentioned, Drew, Arena Group, which is the company that publishes Sports Illustrated, you know, missed a license payment to Authentic Brands Group, which owns Sports Illustrated, which is kind of the precursor to everything that's happening now. Authentic Brands Group pulled a license from Arena. After that, Arena decided to lay off the entire union. Every single member of the Sports Illustrated Union received a layoff notice in late January.
This includes you, is that correct?
This includes me. This includes yours truly. As of now, every single union member will be out of a job after April 26th. The reason I really wanted to talk about it today more than anything is just to remind people that, you know, we all want to work. We all want to work. We've continued to work. Most of us have to continue to work until April 26th. We're still creating a magazine. We're still writing for our website every single day. Like, we obviously think we bring a lot of value to the company. We put out a letter yesterday. We want to work with our next publisher. We want to make sure that the Sports Illustrated Union continues to be a part of Sports Illustrated. That's really what it comes down to. We think that whatever value there is in this magazine, it comes from the writers, the editors, the producers, all the people who for decades now have been making Sports Illustrated what it is, have put it in a position for the name to mean something. We just want all those people to continue to have that opportunity. And it's such a complicated situation with what's going on with this license. And, you know, the situation right now is Authentic Brands is looking for a new publisher, whether that is Arena Group, who most recently held the license, or someone else. Like, we just want to be a part of it. We think that we've obviously contributed a lot to what makes the magazine great. And I think that obviously a lot of people have talked about, is this the end of SI? What's going to happen? I would just like to say that I think that there are a lot of writers on staff who've continued to do great work despite all the turmoil at the company.
That's been the thing that blows me away about it the most. I think we talked about this the last time you were here, is that there's still it's not just that everybody is like showing up every day and doing blogs, which is like, that is enough, honestly. Like if someone gave me a letter and was like, in 3 months, you're on your ass, like with some severance TBD, it would be really hard for me to write a post. Like it's hard for me to write a post most days because there's a lot of fucking bad shit happening in the world and I feel terrible. The idea that somehow like Stephanie Abstein is continuing to lead the coverage of the diaphanous MLB pants issue with the sword of Damocles hanging over her like that is incredible to me. So much of what I've read about the thanks, there's a Ben Strauss story in the Post about the like the current state of SI. There's a million print subscribers. This is not the sort of thing where it's like some desiccated husk and we have to just like remember the football phone. It's still like an industry leading publication that has just not been owned by anybody that wants to own any kind of publication for like what, 8 years now? Like when was the last time? It was when Meredith sold it, right? So like you were working at Deadspin basically the last time anybody cared about this shit.
He may not be able to talk.
Yeah, it's all right.
I'm trying to think what to say. I mean, listen, I appreciate what you're saying about, I agree. I do think we continue to be an industry-leading publication. Let me say that. You mentioned whether it's Steph Abstein, whether it's Emma, who used to work at Deadspin, John Wertheim, Greg Bishop. I can go down the list. Tom Verducci, Chris Mannix. I think we still have a lot of writers who are at the top of their respective fields. I mean, Chris Mannix just had this great interview with Damian Lillard, you know, where Dame was talking about how he feels lonely in Milwaukee. He's going to have an even bigger magazine story on the Bucks. And
I think everyone
soon.
Who lives in Milwaukee feels lonely, though. I just want to note that.
I'm just really proud of the work that everyone on our staff continues to do, despite, as you mentioned, being told that we're all going to be out of a job in less than 2 months now. I'm just really proud of how much everyone continues to take pride in what we do, and that's only because the people in our unit really, really care about Sports Illustrated and just want to make sure that it continues to do great work for as long as we can.
Let me ask you two more questions about it before we make you comfortable and pivot to sandwiches and basketball. The first one is, do you see the potential of Authentic finding a new licensee, I think that's the word, who undoes the layoffs and keeps you employed and keeps everything as it is now at the very best, I would suppose.
Listen, that's certainly our hope. And okay. that's the letter we put out publicly yesterday to ABG, to Arena Group, to any future publisher. Give us a seat at the table. That's all we're asking for. Give us a chance. You know, it's been reported that Authentic made several millions of dollars at their Super Bowl party. You know, clearly there's value in being associated with the Sports Illustrated brand. We think we bring a lot of that value with the work that we do, with the journalism that SI has done for decades. So we hope whoever the publisher ends up being, that they just give us a chance, give us a seat at the table, allow us to do continue to do the work that we think has made so many people care about the magazine in the first place.
Okay, the second question. Have you been happy with the union's advocacy for you guys since this happened? And I only ask because all of us at Defector were quite disappointed with how our union handled the Stick to Sports memo and the ensuing fiasco when we all ended up essentially having to quit because we felt as if we were not getting enough traction behind us from the rest of the, you know, from our representation, you know.
I would differ with that a little bit, but okay, Ron, you should answer the question, I think.
Well, you know, I'll just say for now, I mean, I'm personally pretty happy with the way our own union, our unit itself at Sports Illustrated has responded. I think we've seen a lot of solidarity amongst the staff, and we have a pretty big staff, right? Over 80 people. We've seen solidarity from other unions so far. So, you know, I think right now we're just focused on what we can do internally, I'd say. And I think that is, again, I'm personally pretty, I can't find the right word, but it means a lot to see, at least from the staff perspective, just the unity amongst everyone, and trying to do whatever we can to make sure we're a part of SI's future.
I think that's awesome.
Roth, let me clarify what I said so you can yell at me about it. But once the edict was sort of handed down that we could only write about X-Men, we were like, okay, well, this is bullshit. Like, we should walk out. You know, we should not do anything. And that was, we were actively discouraged from doing that. And we kept getting the cycle of, you know, the union issuing, you know, very sternly worded, you know, public statements about, you know, what Geo Media was doing, fucking with our careers and with our work. And to the point where, you know, every time we saw one of these, you know, every time now when we see a union of any sort, and I'm not talking about the SI union necessarily, but, you know, when we see stern letters issued as opposed to drastic action the way that SAG and the WGA took in the summer of 2023, you know, it's hard for me and a lot of other staffers to feel like that is accomplishing much. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, I agree, like, in the sense that it didn't accomplish much. Like, yeah, right. So that's kind of the hard part with it. I think that for me, so my own briefly union backstory, like, it was a part of unionizing the workplace at Vice when I worked there. It's the same union that we worked with at Deadspin, which is the Writers Guild of America East. I really appreciated the work that they did. I was in awe of the work that they did at Vice, like, in terms of, like, getting us off the ground. I feel like the issue with Deadspin was the issue with our ownership, and the union was slow to recognize that they were dealing with a partner who was not only not acting in good faith, but who did not want to publish our website anymore, and who was maybe ambivalent about the idea of continuing to do any of the work that we had ever done.
Yeah, and they were dumb as fuck, too.
And it's like, I was also slow to recognize that. Do you know what I mean? Like, part of, like, the process, like, the escalation thing that we were doing as a union, you know, and obviously, like, Ron's experience is more germane, more current, and more interesting, is that there's a strategy to how all of this stuff is done. That basically, like, if you issue this threat, then it shows that you're this serious. If you're not met there, there's, like, a way that all of this goes. And it's been sort of built up over the course of years of sort of best practices. All of that assumes that the management that you're dealing with wants to continue to do the work that you're doing. If they don't, then you're pulling on a lever that isn't attached to anything, and you're not going to get any of the traction. None of the stuff that you need to respond to it is actually related to it in any way anymore. You're playing a different sort of game. And I don't know what you do in those circumstances. I mean, that's the issue. And I don't want to, you know, we don't need to talk more about the Sports Illustrated thing. I don't want to put Ron in a tough spot with it. But the bit that I've been struck by with the new owner, we did kind of the same thing with that fucking Sinclair guy that bought the Baltimore Sun, where you come in and you have an all hands on the Zoom and you just tell everybody at the company that you are in charge of what fucking assholes they are and how they don't know how to do their job or whatever, which is not different than what Jim Spanfeller basically was broadcasting to us. At that point, like, I really do think the thing to do is, like, you need to get rid of that owner, which is easier said than done. There's not, like, a union method of doing that there is, but it is the sort of thing where you can only get so far with somebody that's not interested in the same things as you. And that is something I would not ask Rohan to comment on at all. Should we pivot to the NBA?
You know, I don't, no, wait, I do want to expand a little bit to include Rohan, because look, we can expand this to the gray mirror, because it was something that's been on my mind for a while, where I have noticed, obviously, this is not unique to Sports Illustrated. We've witnessed Vice getting essentially destroyed in the past week or in the past month, along with a great many other publications. And what do they all have in common? And actually, Sports Illustrated is a bit of an exception to this, mostly because Albert Breer is still alive. But what they had in common is very pointed liberal journalism. And it seems to me like it is not a conspiracy, but it is basically, and I remember this was a report where Jezebel couldn't sell ads because the advertisers didn't want to be associated with, you know, controversially liberal journalism.
Anything polarizing. Opinion. It was. I mean, it wasn't just abortion. It's like war.
Yeah. Anything like that. So there's two things. One is that these heads of industry clearly don't like this particular type of journalism. It's not that they all collaborated to phase it out. They just don't like it. But then also, it reinforces the legacy media power structure that the Washington Post and more specifically the New York Times have. And it's essentially doing their dirty work for those publications. Like the Times is fucking awful and exists only to serve itself. And hey, there's no real challenges to them anymore because we're all getting fired, right? Yeah. So, Rohan, do you feel the way I feel, or am I being a little too generalizing here?
It's interesting. I mean, it's one of those things like if we're talking about the industry at large right now, it's kind of like the 2016 election, where it's like every reason is the right reason for why this is happening.
Yep.
You know, the truth is, it is also just there have been huge changes in media, even from the time that, you know, the last 10 years, the last 5 years, the last 3 years. There's always a new threat, right? First, it was like Google, then it was Facebook, then it was video, then now it's AI. Like there's always some kind of new threat that I think realistically are difficult for anyone in this business to stay in front of.
I think it's why subscription as an idea came back, is that all the stuff you're talking about is basically someone that used to share money with you decided they wanted to stop sharing money with you.
Right. And that's difficult. And as you guys know, like subscription, I think it certainly has its benefits, but also can narrow your reach or, you know, different things. There are different obstacles.
It's something I've struggled with personally about the subscription model. It's clearly worked for us, but like, All I want to do, you know, I'm an attention whore. Yeah, I want the page views. I want the clicks, baby. Oh, and by the way, our producer Eric Silver is noting that the Gimlet and Ringer unions don't have a contract with Spotify, which expired at the end of February, and have been pleading publicly for fair representation or fair pay, because I remember the Ringer people were saying, "Hey, our regular employees make less than the fucking interns. How is that possible?" So anyway, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you, Rohan.
No, it's there are a lot of obstacles. And I think what you were talking about in terms of the kind of journalism Sun sites do, I agree. It's a little bit different for us. I think there's something to that for sure. But it's like you can point to any one of these reasons, and I feel like say this is the biggest one, and you'd probably have a good argument for it.
Yeah. If the 80 of you are still together and believing in each other and the broader cause, then I have to believe that is meaningful. I mean, I think not just because like it's the foundation of what gets me out of bed in the morning and everything that I believe about politics and society. Although there's also that. I just feel like that's the last thing to go, and it's the thing that they want to break above all else. And as long as you got that, you got a lot. So
yeah, those bonds matter, and it's why I think it's a good idea if you guys, when this is all said and done, you break off and you start your own publication with the name, hear me out, Sports Pictured. What do you think about that?
I don't know if it'll work.
You know, we should talk about sports, and we'll come back and we'll do that. But before we cut to break, I just want to know that this week's show is brought to you by Steve's Mystery Ointment. Got chapped lips, a dried out bike chain, trouble with the missus in the bedroom? Steve's Mystery Ointment can grease all of your wheels. And it comes directly from Steve, a name you can trust. That's Steve's Mystery Ointment, available only at Steve's apartment. Warning, do not apply directly to broken skin. We'll be right back with Rohan Nadkarni.
Thank you, Steve.
Hey, it's Drew. This week's episode is brought to you by Raycon, who offer amazing quality audio at half the price of other premium audio brands. Raycon's optimized gel tips are designed to fit comfortably in your ears and to actually stay there, whether you're biking or running or just chilling at home. I got a pair of Raycon earbuds in the mail the other day, and my wife was like, "Oh, give me, give me, give me, give me, give me." She couldn't wait to use them because not only were they clearly a good product, but they were also quite attractive because they came in cherry red. So with 8 hours of playtime and a 32-hour battery life, you don't have to worry about whether or not their earbuds are up for the task. They also have customizable sound profiles, earbud tap functions, noise isolation, and awareness mode. So go to buyraycon.com/distraction today to get 20% off of your Raycon order plus free shipping. That's right. You'll get 20% off and free shipping if you go to buyraycon.com/distraction. That's buyraycon.com/distraction.
Distraction is sponsored this week by Blue Land. Do you like cleaning the toilet? I don't. I don't think anybody does. It's kind of a weird thing to like. But I can say from experience that Blue Land's toilet tablets make it incredibly easy and strikingly cinematic. They're proven to work on a range of toilet stains, including rust, mineral deposits, lime scale, and hard water. Here's what Blue Land is. It's a company that's on a mission to eliminate single-use plastic by reinventing cleaning essentials to be better for you and better for the planet. And they have the same powerful clean that you're used to. The idea is simple. They offer refillable cleaning products with a beautiful, cohesive design. In the case of the toilet tablet, it's a little purple tin that looks great on your counter. You can refill your reusable bottles with water, drop in the tablets, and wait for them to dissolve. You'll never have to grab bulky cleaning supplies on your grocery run again. And from cleaning supplies to hand soap, toilet bowl cleaner, laundry tablets, all Blue Land products are made with clean ingredients you can feel good about. I mentioned cinematic, not a word you usually use with toilets. The tablet, when you drop it in, it's like a little Alka-Seltzer. It fizzes, you let it sit for a little bit, you give the toilet a scrub, and it is strikingly clean. And fitting them in this little tin instead of having some weird nozzled bottle that makes terrible sounds is a huge win. I recommend it. Blue Land has a special offer for listeners right now. You can get 15% off your first order by going to blueland.com/distraction. You will not want to miss this. It's blueland.com/distraction for 15% off. That's blueland.com/distraction to get your 15% off.
Okay, we're back with Rohan, and we're going to talk about the actual sports stuff now. Specifically,
no, political economy.
Yeah.
Well, sandwich, you know, of the week.
As it so happens, the New York Times released a poll in the headlines that said that 80% of Americans actually think Donald Trump is kind of cute and would like to date him, and that matters a lot. That's big trouble for Joe Biden. Anyway, let's talk about the NBA, Rohan. Right now, the best team in the league is the Boston Celtics, which... Ew. Rohan, can we do anything about this?
No, but what we can do is lean into it and hype them up so much that in the event that they lose, we now get to celebrate just one of the most epic downfalls of all time. And if you notice, if you pay attention, if you are like me and have just been studying the state propaganda of the Democratic People's Republic of Boston for as long as I have, you know that they are, what they're trying to do now is have it the other way. They're like, are the Celtics really as good as the numbers say? Like, you know, are they really this big of a favorite? Should they really be, you know, we all know anything can happen in a series against the Heat. We all know anything can happen in a series against the Bucks. Like, sure, every number would point to the Celtics being an overwhelming favorite, but, you know, the title still runs through Denver.
That is how they're talking about it? Because I'm used to them just sort of being like, Jaylen Brown dribbles with his left hand, so good now, and not a problem anymore.
It's like I will say that they're playing so well that it's getting harder to keep up that facade. Yeah. I think that there was like a moment of that. There was a moment of that, but now it's all back.
They average double-digit victories. They've averaged that for the entire season. That's pretty impressive.
They got 50-point wins in the last week.
They are undoubtedly a juggernaut.
Do you feel as if something has changed with this team compared to previous years where, you know, either the coaching was subpar in the playoffs, or Jaylen Brown would forget how to dribble, or Jason Tatum would take a lot of shitty shots? Like, have they corrected those sort of fundamental flaws that did not allow them to win a title with this core as it stood?
I think that they are just overwhelming teams with talent now in a way that they couldn't in years past, because they got Jrue Holiday, because they got Kristaps Porzingis. Porzingis especially put them in a position where it made them better offensively without sacrificing anything on defense, right? He's such a great rim protector. They have nobody in their starting five that teams can single out and say, we're going to attack this player defensively. Almost every single team, almost every single contender has one of those players. They don't have that. I mean, Jrue Holiday went from having to be at times the second most important player in Milwaukee on a championship team to now most nights the fourth or fifth most important guy. That's made his life so much easier. And I think, you know, some people will say this team still shoots too many threes and need to take so many shots at the rim. The problem is on the other end of the floor, whereas no team has a mismatch against Boston, Boston will find the one mismatch every night. They'll say, we'll post that player up. We'll get a switch. We'll post that player up with Jason Tatum. You have to bring a double team. Next thing you know, they're getting an open corner three. They swing the ball, they're getting an open three. They're just so well balanced that I think, you know, even if you say maybe they don't have the best coach, maybe they shoot too many threes, which I think is kind of a flimsy criticism to begin with.
Yeah, it's like you could say it about basically every NBA team.
Yes,
you
know, exactly. Like, they have the talent to pull it off, and I think that it's going to be very difficult in a playoff series if all five of their starters are playing 40 minutes to find the advantages against them.
Do you think Porzingis can last that long?
The way I look at it is it's like you can say anyone's going to get injured. You know what I mean? And obviously, like, he has a little bit more history of it.
Yes, he does.
But I basically put it this way. I don't really factor that in. If he gets hurt, he gets hurt. But you could say that about, you know, any star player on any team. They're going to be different if they get hurt. So I understand why it's obviously more of a concern with Porzingis. But assuming he does hold up, and I think one thing that will help is he's not playing with a pressure or a burden that he has on some of these other teams because of how much talent is around him. That should also help him physically.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say in terms of, because I've had an easier time believing it, first of all, then I would like, second of all, then I've ever had in the past, just because of the fact that he doesn't have to do as much, that this is like, it isn't quite as simple as they replace Marcus Smart and Grant Williams with Jrue Holiday and Kristaps Porzingis, but it's not that different than that. Yes. Either. And that is, like, if you think of Porzingis and what he's been asked to do everywhere else, it's like, if you asked him to do the volume of shit that Grant Williams did, then, like, there's a chance that there's more tread on the tires at the end of the year than there, like, ever has been in any of his other seasons where he's been asked to be the one or the two option on a team.
Exactly.
But doesn't it still come down to Tatum and Brown? Like, isn't that what's going to matter when the playoffs come around?
I agree to an extent. And at the same time, I mean, Tatum's delivered. He's delivered, and I think, you know, he's someone who, when they needed him to score 30 points a night, he did that. And his scoring's down a little bit this year. And I think over the years, he's become a better passer. So I think that he's kind of fit the role of what they needed from him. And, you know, people kind of get on the Celtics for making it so far and not competing or not finishing the job. But I mean, they also it really far. They also make it really far every year, in part because of Jason Tatum. You just think, you know, one year they're down 3-2 going to Milwaukee to play the Bucks. He has one of the great game sixes of the last few years. Last year, game six in Philly, he's struggling the whole game. Last 3 minutes, he just takes over while Harden and Embiid disappear. So I think he's had plenty of big playoff moments, and he can compete with anybody in the East in terms of who's going to be the best player on the floor on a nightly basis. It brings me no pleasure to say this.
Right, I was going to say.
Yeah.
I just don't like the idea of tuning into the playoffs and then, like, for a majority of games, I gotta, you know, watch the Celtics and then see fucking Hard Seltzer Spokes Dwarf and see fucking Hard Seltzer Spokes Dwarf Dave Portnoy sitting in the front row at the fucking
Listen,
Tea Garden.
At this point, we have nothing to lose by letting the hype get out of control, because either they win and no one's impressed, or they lose and everyone is making fun of them for being one of the, you know, quote unquote best teams to lose. So
it is also kind of fun that they're as good as they are. Like, I'm not going to watch a whole Celtics game necessarily because I've got a lot of stuff going on in my life. I think we both, everyone knows that that's not true, but I have other things going on in my life that I'm not going to sacrifice on the altar of the Celtics, but they are fucking incredible to watch. Like, you can, even leaving aside my distaste for the team and the fan base, with the exception of our producer, Eric Silver, a wonderful guy, like, they're incredible. Like, they really seem about, like, I don't know, 5 or 10% better than every other NBA team right now, which is ridiculous. I mean, not that much better than the Nuggets or the Clippers, if they're right or whatever. But, like, the teams that they play most nights, they're a lot better than. And that is not a common NBA thing. Like, even, like, a good NBA team against a bad NBA team in a game that winds up, you know, being a 12-point win for the good team, you don't necessarily see that difference as starkly as you did when the Celtics beat down the Warriors over the weekend. Like, that just looked unfair. And that's kind of, I mean, it's not like fun because it's the Celtics, but it is like an interesting new basketball watching experience that I, with, you know, the usual caveats, would recommend to our listeners.
They are. I agree. That's the thing. I agree. And it's Heat fans are making fun of me all the time for being like a sleeper Celtics fan, not even a sleeper one. They used to refer to me as a Celtics fan or Celtics Twitter, but objectively, they are a good watch. I mean, and it's not just because they can score. Like, they actually play really good defense. So, you know, people always complaining, oh, nobody back in the day, they used to, you know, you couldn't come into the lane without getting six teeth knocked out. But
the Barkley complaint.
Yeah, exactly. They're playing good defense, too. I've found them to be an incredibly aesthetically pleasing watch the last couple of years, to be honest.
Let's go over to the West now, because the top three seeds as we record this podcast are the defending champion Nuggets, but also the Thunder and the Timberwolves. Meanwhile, both the Warriors and the Lakers are fighting for a play-in spot. Rohan, are we witnessing a generational transition at the top of the Western Conference right now, or is that way too premature on my part?
I think we're seeing a transition in terms of Jokic is the best player in the NBA. And
right.
As long as he is, like, caring about basketball and wanting to win championships, I think the Nuggets are going to be the toughest team to beat in the Western Conference for the foreseeable future. As long as you have him, Jamal Murray together, they're going to be an incredible issue. Now, the only reason I'll push back on that slightly, and I'm not saying that you're necessarily advocating for it, is I do think LeBron and Steph, you mentioned the Warriors and Lakers, they could be in a position to be winning a championship if their front offices built a team as well around them as the Nuggets have with Jokic, as well as the Thunder have with Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, as well as the Timberwolves have with Anthony Edwards. And the Timberwolves deserve a lot of credit because everyone was getting the jokes off about the Rudy Gobert trade. He's been fantastic. Mike Conley's been fantastic.
It looked really bad until it started looking incredibly good.
But yeah. You go up and down the list, Naz Reid, McDaniels, Nikhil Alexander-Walker. Like, they got just a lot of great players on the team. Slow-mo Anderson, who, by the way, I think sometimes is doing a bit. Like, I'm convinced he's playing into the slow-mo Nick Dame a little bit sometimes with how slow he's going.
It would, like, honestly, that would be reassuring, because otherwise it would be weird if he's just like the one guy that plays like he's got cross country skis on, but he still gets like 10 points a game.
He's like you know, it's like trying to stir a jar of tahini with that guy. Yep. Just
it's such a pain in the ass.
Yeah.
Jersey City's own, though. We do it differently.
Stirring a separated nut butter should be an Olympic event. It's such a pain in the ass.
So I wouldn't say we're seeing full on changing of the guard, because I think those guys on those teams that you mentioned lower in the standings are still very good. Having said that, I think we are seeing legitimate bona fide stars emerge in Anthony Edwards, in Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, in Chet Holmgren. What the Thunder and Wolves have done has been awesome.
And we haven't even gotten to Wemby, because his team is shit, but that's not going to be the case for very long.
So they're shit, but I think they're, like, better than they were.
They've improved over the course of the season.
Like, they were also, like, they were making some moves, some, like, very advanced tanking maneuvers early in the season where Jeremy Sohan did his best. They took a college power forward and started him at point guard for the first 25-30 games of the year. That's very bold. That is like a new way to make sure that your team won't accidentally win half its games like the Jazz did last year and fuck yourself out of a lottery spot. Like, it's, no one had thought of that before. You got to tip your cap to Pop. He's still innovating.
They're tanking for Caitlin Clark. It's so obvious.
I watched the Thunder the other night and was reminded. So the Wolves, it's like I've gotten used to that, because I feel like even last year I was kind of like, well, if this works, this is going to make sense. The Thunder has always been this kind of like disaggregated collection of incredibly sharp tools that no one's figured out how to sort of like put together just yet. And they figured out how to put it together. I mean, I guess it's like mostly it helps to have Chet Holmgren. It was weird to watch them get pushed around by Jusuf Nurkić. This was the game they wound up beating the Suns, lost a big lead, came back and wound up winning it. There's still like issues there in terms of rebounding and stuff like that. But the Thunder having made, and again, this is while we're doing recommendations, having like abruptly become an extremely serious and extremely good team in the course of basically like last year, they were like spunky, but not quite good yet, is pretty neat to watch too. Like in terms of just, you know, I don't want to compare it to the scene in She's All That where Rachel Lee Cook takes her glasses off.
Too late.
It's like that level of instantaneous sort of conversion. It's fun to check in on it.
Turns out hot girl is hot. Who knew? Yeah.
Can I say something? You joke about the Spurs wanting to draft Caitlin Clark. Can I just say something?
You mentioned Rachel Lee Cook.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm zagging on Caitlin Clark, dude. Just get her out of my face.
It's too much.
Wait. Go back for a second. Zagging, is that Zoomer slang? What does that mean?
Like, instead of, like, you never heard of, like, the I'm zagging on this take, like, podcast bit setup? No. Okay. Completely baffled here that that's...
It's just, you can figure it out for
you know
context.
How fucking...
Let the man talk.
You
let
know
him
how
do
old
his,
and white I am, right?
Let him speak, and then you'll know what zagging is. And
yeah, that's downstairs okay. Very,
oh, wait, Eric clarified it's the opposite of zig. Okay, so all right.
I went to Northwestern during what you could say was, like, you know, the back end of the height of the Northwestern-Iowa rivalry, if such thing were to ever exist.
many are saying that.
Yeah.
Everyone knows exactly when you're talking about.
So, like, I just had, like, a completely unnecessarily extreme disdain for Iowa for, like, a four-year period in my life. Like, so it's just, like, naturally extended to Caitlin Clark. So in like that whole Jay Williams thing was popping off. It's like, she can't be great. She doesn't win a championship. I was like, let him cook. Let him cook. You know, just
it's incredible to be such a hater that you're like, Jay Williams is, these are bars
I was
right
like,
here.
I like, refuse to be moved by this cool Nike ad.
your basis though for zagging, as the kids say, is legit though, because it came from, you know, your status as a Northwestern alum, which is its own problem, but don't worry about that.
It's equally problematic because I had just been misogynistic, like it would
right if you had been like, well, I'm zagging her because she's a girl, like, that would have been a problem.
I think the funniest possible way to wind up wrong about Caitlin Clark, in my opinion, would have you just been like, I don't see it.
Yeah, see it. Here's the thing, man. It's like, do it in the pros. That's all I'm going to say. Do it in the pros.
Exactly.
She's
basically Monte Ellis minus.
Once defensive coordinators get tape on her, forget it.
Exactly.
It's all over.
Exactly.
Finesse player. We'll do one more thing. We're going to get to the fun bag, but I did want to bring it up because we haven't talked about it. Russell Wilson was released by Denver this week. It doesn't take effect until the June 6th date or whatever, but he'll cost the Broncos $85 million in dead cap space over the next two seasons. Rohan, was this the worst signing in NFL history?
Ooh, boy. Worst. I hesitate to say worst only because it feels like the team has like an equal level of culpability here. Like, by all accounts, they did hire Aaron Rodgers' friend to be the coach of the team. But neglected to sign Aaron Rodgers.
Bit of an issue.
Which, like,
they were
some
startled
problems.
To discover that someone who gets along with Aaron Rodgers turns out to be a knucklehead.
And, was so shockingly bad that the NFL had a coach, like, willing to admit it. Like, Sean Payton was willing to admit that the coach was bad. And Nathaniel Hackett was like, Nathaniel Hackett didn't even defend the job he did in Denver. He was just like, well, you're not supposed to say that. Like, you're really not. Like, he wasn't even like,
The Marge Simpson line where it's like, it's true, but you shouldn't say it.
Yeah. It's like, he wasn't even like pointing to successes he had. He was just like, where I come from, you don't say that. So
no one talks about all the times that we successfully punted without incurring a delay of game penalty.
Exactly.
We only remember the five or six, like, where we weren't able to do it.
It was like that. The literal first game Russell Wilson played with the Broncos in Seattle when they like didn't go for it on 4th and 2. And it's like, we're like, we're going to kick like a 78 yard field goal or whatever it was. I'm like, yeah, okay,
it was like 64 yards. Yeah, it was fucking deranged.
And I was like, okay, like I don't blame him for this. Like, this is clearly not going to work. And I don't think it's his fault. So I hesitate to say worse because I think the team has a level of culpability here to the point where like they finally started winning games last year and threatened to bench him anyway. Like,
They did bench him. They fucking benched him for Jared Stidham.
So I hope that with Russell Wilson, in fact, guaranteed to make dozens and dozens of millions of dollars the next couple of years, no matter what, this is the time for him to take a team friendly deal with the Dolphins and compete for the starting spot with Tua in training camp.
He actually has to. Like, this has been established that he is going to sign for the minimum for 1 year with some team because then it somehow his Denver contract.
Oh, it has the offset language.
Yeah, there's some sort of offset. Like, so in order to collect all that money from the Broncos, he has to sign for the minimum elsewhere, which is like, that's a pretty nice deal compared to paying $100 million for like Baker Mayfield. You know, like,
yes.
Yeah. So what I was going to say is that I've been thinking about this since Drew first raised the question at work. And I think it's like the initial question was, is the Russell Wilson trade the worst trade in NFL history? And it's like, as with the Deshaun Watson thing, it's the trade wasn't great. It's the immediate extension to make good on the deal that compounds how bad it was. Like, they gave up too much for Russell Wilson and they didn't get a whole good season out of him. That's bad. It's the extra bit that sort of is like the cloud that's going to hang over.
And he hasn't even played under the extension yet. They released him before the extension kicked it.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, that's and all right. I was going to mention Deshaun because that has been a complete fucking disaster, not just morally, but like from a football standpoint. But then the other thing is that both of these deals, and you know, I should be, you know, more read up on this, but I can't imagine either of those deals being consummated, either of the trades being consummated without the extensions already pre-agreed to before.
Absolutely,
they went
down,
right? So it's almost like you kind of have to include the extension in the trade. And if you do that with Deshaun Watson, I mean, that is a fucking disaster. That's, I mean, the fact that they flourished with the fucking corpse of Joe Flacco.
Joe Flacco. Joe Flacco.
They did better with Joe Flacco than fucking Deshaun Watson. That is just brutal to me.
Rohan mentioned it. Drew, you've mentioned it not on the mic. Russell Wilson on a one-year deal, quarterbacking your team. Both of you guys are cool with that. Like, you would want to see
the day the Dolphins lost to the Chiefs in the playoffs, I like had to have like a midnight conversation with my brother. I was like, all right, let's do this. And just discussed quarterback options for an hour. And like, just so
grown
bleak,
man
like,
talk.
just pure like McDaniel doesn't run the ball enough, or like, can Tua throw in the wind? Like, just pure.
Right. Yeah. I know that. I know
football,
that state.
Pure football brain takery for like an hour. And then we were just openly debating Russell Wilson versus Kirk Cousins for a solid 30 minutes. Oof. And I think my brother is more team Kirk. But I think...
Would you rather have Kirk than Tua?
I think they... The problem is they have... Like, they're letting Christian Wilkins walk, which I hate. I think he's great.
Yeah, he fucking rocks. He's so
cool
good.
As hell. And I'm like, would I rather have Christian Wilkins, Jalen Ramsey, Waddle, Tyreek Hill, and Russell Wilson, or like two of those guys and Tua? After the way the Dolphins ended the season, I don't know. I'm willing to talk myself into Russell Wilson, maybe.
They are going to extend Tua. I mean, I hate to tell you that.
Like, it does seem to be what's going to happen.
They're gonna give him bank. As for Kirk, I'm not gonna go too far on Kirk because whatever, you've heard enough of that. But I did realize the other night when I was stoned, that you know the axiom about buying a boat. Do you guys know that old joke?
Yeah, that the happiest days are when the day you get it and the day you sell it.
Yeah, that's Kirk. That's I just want you to know.
Hey, this is reminding me of something, which is so I saw Drew the other day tweeting like his plan for the Vikings offseason and what they should do.
Yeah, that sounds like me.
And I was like, wow, like good for Drew. Like he's still like really like tweeting like it's 2012, like Just, and I don't mean this in a derogatory way. I'm like, this is cool. Like he's still using this medium in the way that like it was intended to be used, which was like, just get your takes off about things that you like. And I'm like, all right, this is cool. Which then like, and then as I'm thinking about that, while Drew's talking about the Vikings, it reminded me that Roth has just given it up. But that, yeah, it'd be like if Scorsese just stopped making movies after Goodfellas. You know what I mean? He's like, he made Goodfellas. He's like, I'm done. And it's like Barry Sanders walking away. What?
I appreciate you saying that. These are both very flattering comps. I think because I'm still doing the stupid posts just on Blue Sky, it's more like if Scorsese stopped making movies and was like, I'm just going to, everything's for Quibi now. It's all going to be like.
It would be like if he pivoted to Netflix when Netflix was still doing DVDs in the mail.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It was just like, I'm going to do like Highlander sequels for the video store that lives in your mailbox. Yeah, that's the thing that's hard. And I do respect, you know, while we're underlining this again, in both instances, I think this is going to come off as faint praise to Drew, but it is like, that's the way that you, you know, make a social media platform what you want it to be is by putting the kind of posts on it that you want to see on there. And
yeah, like, be Twitter, the shit like, posting you see in the world.
And that's what Elon did to Twitter, and it's why it sucks ass now. But when he was like, I want to see more pussies in bio. I want to see more, like, what I want to see is like more people selling me a shit coin that is obviously a scam, like in my replies. Like, that's what he thinks is cool. And, you know, like, I've been trying to do the sort of posts that I want to see on Blue Sky, but it's hard because, like, the world is really bad and you're feeling a lot of, like, dread and shame every day. So the idea of me being like, what if Jeremy Irons bought a ticket for Dune? It might sound a little bit like June. Like, I'm doing my best. Do you know what I mean? But it's hard.
I just forget that I have the Blue Sky app on my phone. And then, like, every 7 weeks I'll remember, and I'm like, let me see what Roth has been up to.
Yeah, that's nice of you. But I mean, a lot of what's on there, and I'm trying not to do this, is being like, you wouldn't believe the shit I saw on Twitter. And it's like, yeah, I would. I promise you I would. Like,
by the way, multiple occasions recently, I've been scrolling through Twitter and seen ads that have a reader clarification.
Yes,
it's like,
yes,
this
yes.
is a scam.
Yes, like, yes. It got community noted. Yeah.
Yeah. Like this might be a
community noting an ad is like, I guess you do kind of got to hand it to him on that one. Like, that's a good use of the technology, but
that's great. Every ad is like, this is, find out what Joe Biden doesn't want you to know. Creamy Joe is up to no good.
And then the thing itself is being like, this is they want your social security number. If you want to find out anything, they got to get all the dig.
Time to open up the fun bag. These are real questions from defector readers and distraction listeners. This is from Peter Rohan. He writes in, what advertising song completely ruined that song for you? I can't hear Aretha Franklin's Rescue Me. That's Martha and the Vandellas, Peter. I'm sorry to tell you that. Oh, without thinking of ass. Come on Pizza Hut and Rescue Me. And no naming Bob Seger, because I'm pretty sure that sellout wrote Like a Rock specifically for Chevy.
Wow.
Have you had any song ruined for you by an ad?
Yes, but nothing comes to mind right now. Like, I more so get like a deep guttural rage at jingles that I hate than like songs. I have
so like Cars for Kids and shit.
Yes, Cars for Kids.
We're all Burger thinking King. Of Cars yeah, for
yes,
Kids.
Yes.
I'm glad that Drew said it, but it's like,
somebody doesn't like that song.
You have the Ring videotape, yes. And you're like, you're going to hate this. Can you mind if I put this in real quick?
I'm sorry.
You mention it.
I once had some, like, we used to do like a basketball show at SI, and they had to like cut out some jokes I made about what I wish would happen to the Cars for Kids.
They're like, we can't. Too hot for SI.
Like, they're like, we can't run this on our like pay for TV like subscription thing that I maybe 8 people watch the show. I don't know. They never told me a number, but they're like, nope.
Yeah.
I will say, unfortunately, advertising does work on me. And there are in fact songs that I'm like stick with me to this day, like commercial remixes that I in fact like love.
Where they like
what are they
new lyrics on a thing? Or
yes, so South Florida used to have, it must still exist because I hope to buy a car from them one day because of the commercials, was this like local car company called Maruni. First of all, Dan Marino was the spokesman for a long time, which is just perfect.
Terrific.
They did like
Marino Maruni. It all makes sense.
They did like a Ghostbusters remix that was like, if you need a car, truck, or van, who are you going to call? Maruni.
It's not even the right number of syllables.
And I was like, this whips. Like when you were a kid growing up in South Florida during that era, like all you wanted was a freaking car from Maruni one day.
Yep.
So like stuff like that. Like Jimmy Butler does like a beer commercial where he's singing Hootie and the Blowfish, Only Want to Be With You. And there's like really? A part. Yes. And there's a part in the ad. I guess like in the song, he's like, I won't dance or something like that. Like that's one of the lyrics. But Jimmy Butler does an ad lib where he's like, yes, I will. And just starts dancing. And the number of times I would just do that walking through my apartment during the NBA playoffs.
Did he have the Jermaine Stewart hairdo in this ad, or did that come later?
He did not. He had his normal braids, and that I can confirm.
Remember Jermaine Stewart.
I can confirm that commercial was filmed on an actual airplane. By the way, just want to throw that out there for our loyal listeners.
Wow. Oh, that's right. Because you were probably there.
I was not. I was so
what level of access?
Hootie pilled by this commercial that I needed to know everything about it. I was like, where was this filmed?
Yeah, getting the Hootie pilled is an especially shameful one. But you don't necessarily control as a person what's going to stick in your head or not.
Yes.
And you were saying, you know, as a kid, like local television advertising, like your brains are especially febrile at that age, but also your discernment is like as bad as it will ever get.
Yes.
So it's just everybody's getting in, and then you don't know who's gonna like be impossible to eject from the party decades down the line. That is so very very relatable.
I haven't had songs ruined for me, but I've been very angry if a song I like is used in a manner that I find like I remember I saw a shitty trailer for Charlie's Angels, and they used Millionaire by Queens of the Stone Age. Or I think, you know, it's in the movie. It's in like the opening sequence, which I think that's as far as I got. But I was like, oh man, this is bullshit.
I feel so bad for Peter because this is a fantastic question. And there are definitely songs that annoy me. I can't remember them because they annoy me so much. I do whatever I can to suppress those memories. Those Chevy Like a Rock commercials were brutal, though. I'll say that.
That's what made me want to be a sports writer because I'm virtually certain it was in SI. It was a back page essay in SI. It wasn't Rick Riley. It was someone else like Steve Rushin or someone like that, complaining specifically about Like a Rock ads being on during the NCAA tournament.
Yep.
And I was like, finally someone said out loud, I fucking hate that song. I'm so mad.
I'm a bit of a Seeger guy, I guess. I mean, like, not. Fun. I mean, I just think
Hell yeah.
Everybody sort of is. I mean, he's like,
I'm not.
You know,
I don't.
He's like a major American. He's a Michigan excellence figurehead. At the very least, we can all agree on that.
Like people, particularly Michigan people, like jerking off to Bob Seeger, like he's the most important rock star to ever live. Like, get the fuck out of here.
Clearly, Gordon Lightfoot.
I will say that commercials make me hate people maybe more than the songs. Like. Jake from State Farm. So speaking, to tie it all together, I saw a video posted that it's like Travis Scott shows up to Caitlin Clark's like record-breaking game. And then it's like, so someone tweets out the video, like, you won't believe who he daps up 10 seconds in. And it's Jake from State Farm. And I'm like, the hell do you need to be at this game for, man? Like, what are you doing here?
They've done crowd shots of Jake from State Farm.
Why?
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, man. What is his name even? Like, aren't you embarrassed? Like everyone
knows
you. It's
a weird type of fame, though, right? Because it's like he's probably there because he has to be there. Like, I'm not saying he's mad.
Right.
But he's paid to be there. Yeah,
his character is like the weird, like, insurance zealot of like basketball vibes. And so wherever something is happening, he's there and he's got to wear the fucking polo. Like, he's not there as like the guy named Jeff that he really is when he like goes home at the end of the day. Right. He has to go there and presumably everybody's calling him fucking Jake and he's like, I love that. I love when that happens. Yeah. Like, that's until he leaves
him.
That's it.
Him and the progressive woman. I need like the old school MTV celebrity death match between those two.
Yep. Especially in, I don't know a thing about Jake, but we talked about the the fact that like Flo is apparently like a legend in UCB in Los Angeles. That she's like one of the funniest people that, and yeah, like in Katie Weaver's story about her, like Kristen Wiig is like, yeah, she's the funniest person I've ever worked with.
Gosh.
Like she's like apparently like a genius. And yet like her job now is like to wear a wig, but then she also gets compensated. Like she gets paid as much per year as like Bobby Portis.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like it's great work if you
she
can
makes
get it.
Bank.
It's just like not, you know, it sucks because you can't do the other stuff that you want to do.
Right.
I was thinking about, so this is a very good question. We've come to the probably the end of the answer. The meta answer, the first thing that popped into my head is not actually from a commercial, but I think the thing that helped me understand Van Halen in a way that I had not understood Van Halen personally is, and this is well before Rohan's time, and it might be that the whole ad, you just can't talk about it anymore. The old Saturday Night Live Schmitz gay ad, which was basically the idea of like a beer for that was like for gay men that had the same vibes as like the horny 80s beer commercials, except it's all dudes.
Right, right.
Was playing On Top of the World, like the Van Halen song. And
yeah,
I was sort of like,
great.
But like that is better, not just better than any beer commercial that was being made then. Like that's what Van Halen is. Like Van Halen is just like all purpose, like horny 80s Los Angeles energy that can be applied to any surface and make it shine in a way that is a little uncomfortable.
Did you know that if you watch that sketch now, they lost the rights to use that song? So
it's
stock Van Halen instead of Van Halen.
It won't work.
Ruins the sketch.
Yep.
Like you needed Van Halen in that. You need David Lee Roth.
Nothing stupider than that. You have to have the stupidest thing.
Last question. This is from Brian. Rohan, listen carefully. It's a little long, but that's all right. Okay. I happened to catch a Julia Child rerun last week with none other than Rick Bayless, and it got me thinking, how many other siblings can you think of who have reached objective levels of fame independent of one another's success? In this case, we have a man who is famous for cooking and has his name on products that you can buy at grocery stores all over the place. On the other hand, we have his brother Skip, a man famous for wearing MJs and a necklace with his name on it to work, while yelling about Dak and asserting that Troy Aikman was gay in a book. For the purposes of this exercise, I'm excluding athletic families who excel at different sports, so like Klay Thompson and his brother, blah, blah, blah. The best I can come up with is probably the Emmanuel brothers, Rom, Ari, and the Doctor, but I'm not sure most people actually know them or if they're all brothers. Maybe talk me into the Attenboroughs. Who do you got, Rohan? Oh, wow. We just blew Eric's mind. He did not know that Eric and Skip Bayless were brothers.
Sorry. My eyes went blank when you said the name Rick Bayless. Have I told you how much I despise Rick Bayless?
You hate Rick Bayless?
Bro.
Wow.
He's my least favorite Bayless. Let me put it that way.
Wow. You're sagging on Rick Bayless. Yes, holy shit.
Bro. It just... Okay. So...
Do you think the food is trash or you just don't like the energy?
Let me,
appropriation?
Hold on. Let me explain exactly where this started. Not to take you guys back to my Northwestern days for another time on this podcast, something that I try to keep heavily under wraps. But there used to be a Sbarro's pizza that you could get a slice, buy one, get one slices at the last 15 minutes it was open. And someone who's like there at the student center every single night,
college town excellence, yes, right there
at the newspaper.
And if you're drunk, that's great.
I would go down there and eat that pizza often. They replaced that and NU sushi with a Frontera Fresco, just serving hella overpriced Mexican food. And it, like, you know, you get like so on your meal plan, you get these meal equivalents. Like meals, right? And it's like up to $12 you can buy something at the student center on your meal plan, except everything at this damn Frontera place was too expensive. Yeah. So you couldn't fit it into your meal plan. And I was so sick of it. And then I'm like, oh, this must be some really fancy, you know, Mexican place that they're doing this. And it's like, no, it's Skip Bayless's white brother being the authority on Mexican cuisine in freaking Chicago. I was like, are you kidding me? Get out of here. I was so mad. Yeah, man.
That's a bad application of, like, you can't gentrify a student center.
Yes,
like,
yes.
These kids are animals. Like, Sbarro is what they need. Like,
right.
If you give them anything better than that, it is wasted.
It's like, I don't need your like, Cochinita Pibil torta right now, dude. I need two slices of pizza for, you know, $6 or whatever it was. Yeah, so Rick Bayless, truly, eat my shorts, dude. I'm sick of that dude. If I ever see Rick Bayless... it's on site. Like, I don't, you know. Oh my God.
My counterpoint to that is that, because I'm broadly speaking, like, it's not a question for me who my favorite Bayless is.
Right.
But I do appreciate your argument there. But most of the experience I've had of Rick Bayless that's positive is the salsa, which if you can get it in supermarkets, is good. The Frontera salsa is good.
The fire roasted salsa is like the goat salsa.
It's rock so solid.
Stop it.
And then also the so the scenario that Rohan's describing, where they took something that was cheap and bad, and then they made it expensive and maybe good, but it fucked you up. Rick Bayless, like, has the Tortas Frontera in the airports
Dude,
in Chicago.
I was just about to talk about that.
Are incredibly clutch. It's the best airport food I've ever had, but it is also like, it is the opposite of the scenario that Ron is describing, where it's like basically like two pieces of Sbarro shoveled in the direction of a kid whose eyes are turning in different directions because they were partying all night. That's like, that is what that kid wants. If you asked me to pay $17 for a little ass sandwich with like a sprig of cilantro as the garnish in the city where I live, like, honestly, I would probably still do it. My problems are a matter of public record at this point. But in the airport, I'm like, hell yeah, man. Like, it looked like you really braised that meat. Like, that is not just something that was like you opened a pouch and added warm water to it and put it on there. So I will always think highly of him because he took this incredibly dire dining experience and elevated it to a solid B.
See, I'm not down with the O'Hare Frontera because there's always a line.
There is always a line.
There's always a line. And then you order it and it's like the fucking food truck wait where it's like,
yeah,
it's a food truck and you're like, oh, well, they must make it fast. They don't. You always got to wait a fucking 45 minutes for your Korean taco or whatever the fuck. And it's the same deal at that joint. And every time I go, I'm like, I have the sort of the yuppie thing where it's like, ooh, Frontera tortas. Well, with barbecoa,
this isn't
quite
Blimpies. I'm rich, by the way. Yeah.
No, exactly. I could just go to a fucking Chick-fil-A, like a fucking concourse.
Yeah, I'm a loyalist to the O'Hare McDonald's, and you'll never get a cent of my money at the Torta Frontera.
I made it enemy for life. All right, yeah. I understand it.
We never answered the question, but you know what? It's fine.
What was the question?
Oh, distinguished
famous,
brothers.
Famous siblings who don't do the same thing.
Okay.
And I don't...
Just like
I
name count, some siblings, basically?
Well, I don't
remember
count
some
Ari,
siblings.
I don't really count Ari and Rahm Emanuel because even though one's in Hollywood and one's in politics, it's kind of the same job. Like you're... You're a high grade bullshitter and a power broker. I don't feel like that. It's not like Ari Emanuel like is a really famous like needlework artist or something like that. Like, you know, it's just not. I'm not there yet.
I will tip the cap to the Emanuels though. All of them being extremely widely loathed for different reasons. That is not easy. Like ordinarily it's like no one's got anything bad to say about fucking Trace Thompson. There's probably Clay haters out there, but they're like, I feel like Trace like deserved a better shot. Could have been a fourth outfielder for a lot of good teams for a long time. Nobody's trying to say anything nice about any of the Emanuels. Like the doctor is the one that people seem to like the most. And there's still like, I don't know, 25% of America is like, he is using robots they're in the vaccines to turn your sperm into socialists. And that is scientifically proven. And like, so if you've got that many enemies and you're literally just a public health specialist, then the family has done something remarkable.
Yeah. We really do have to tip your cap there. And you know what? We did indirectly get some sandwich talk in there. So that's pretty nice.
I know we're over in
No,
overtime.
Fuck you. Oh, yeah, sure.
One last little bit of it. We're talking about Tortas Frontera. If there's a Tortas Frontera near my house, I might not go there. If there's one in an airport, I'm willing to consider it. I have an example of the apex of that, a place that I'm always delighted to see in an airport, but would really only visit in a desperate situation elsewhere, which is Potbelly sandwiches.
Mm. That's a strong, strong answer.
I like Potbelly fine, but in an airport, I'm like, oh my God, things are looking up. Like, this is it for Davey. They got hot peppers here.
That's like because you're walking along the concourse and it's like Burger King, Burger King, Burger King, Burger King. And you're like, fuck, I'm going to die of starvation. There's nothing to fucking eat. And then it's like, the pot belly
oasis. Oh, yeah, just appears.
A wreck.
Yep.
Wow. Fresh romaine.
I don't even know how good it actually is. It's just the sort of thing where in the context where you find it, it's so clearly the best that I like, I don't know, I wouldn't say revere it, but I don't know that I wouldn't say revere it, you know?
It's better than Jimmy John's and Subway.
Somehow,
no, zero doubt.
Somehow Potbelly, it's weird, like they only exist when I'm going somewhere. Like I've never,
yes,
I've never lived within 100 miles of a Potbelly somehow, but whenever I'm like in Phoenix or I'm in an airport, it's like there's always one within 6 feet. It's like, yep, they move locations based on, I agree, like Potbelly is, I've only ever been when I'm like traveling for work and I'm like, I just need a relatively normal sandwich that's not from Subway right now.
Yeah.
And right. I feel like Potbelly really, really scratches that itch. Also, this is like unrelated, but a part of that problem is like, as I've shifted into full on coastal elitist, like how hard it is to just find like a decent slice of bread outside of New York and Los Angeles somehow. It's like, we're just, that's when you need
like
the
for sandwich
of,
purposes.
Yes, yes,
yeah.
That's when you need the pot bellies of the world.
With the toaster, is that it'll take the bread that is like, if you see what pot belly bread looks like before they put it through the sandwich, yeah, it's like if the like the Poppin' Fresh dough guy could shit. Like that's what it looks like. It's just like a little.
Oh, is it like white, the par? Is it like the par baked baguettes, yeah, you buy at the fucking grocery store, yep, that go moldy in 5 seconds.
But once it comes out the other side of that thing, you're kind of like, you know what? Like, and it's, yeah, that, yes, is, that's solid. Like, that's.
Can I admit something real quick?
Yes, please.
I mean, you, that's all you do on this podcast.
That's true. Right? So, you know, we were talking about commercials and how effective they are on me.
Yep.
And for a solid 2.5 years now, I've been inundated by Subway allegedly revamping the menu, you know.
Yeah, and Steph Curry goes there, yeah, now.
By the way, my dad will just be like, just out of nowhere, like be silent, literally haven't heard him speak a word all day. And then a Subway commercial comes on and be like, the sandwiches don't look like that. There's no way Steph Curry.
God damn it.
Yeah.
And, good for him. He's right.
Like, yeah,
that's not even a real sandwich. They're using a model.
And he's constantly shitting on our local Subway next to Publix. Like he'll come home from Publix and be like, no one in Subway again. Like, okay.
Thanks, Dad.
That's great.
Keep me posted.
A field report on Subway.
Yeah, he's like, I never see anyone in there. My mom's like, I've seen a couple people in there. He's like, when?
Answer me.
Also, a bad Subway is as bad a vibe as you're going to get fast food-wise. So, like, there was one by us that finally closed that it was, like, lit like Don Corleone's office, yeah, in The Godfather. Like, I don't want anyone making me food in the dark like that. Like, yes. I would turn on a light in my own home.
Having said that, I ate one a couple months ago. It was not terrible. It was not. Yep. It was. It kind of was fine, if I'm being honest.
They got another bread place problem. Where. As far as I'm concerned,
the bread could be worse, though. I think that this is to like Rohan's point.
It's not the highest compliment.
But when they put the Italian herbs and cheese on there, I'm just, yep, saying. I'm just, you know.
Yeah, because if the alternative is one of those things that's just basically like a weird, like gum made of flour, mm-hmm, like just like subpar hoagie roll shit from a deli. Like, I will take a weird, crumbly, dry, artificial Asiago accents on the outside, yeah, of it, Subway bread over that.
How do you guys feel about scooped bread in your subs?
Scooped bread?
Like, yeah, you, I don't ever find it necessary.
The bread for you. Oh, you mean like scooping out the bagel?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't do it with
too many carbs.
I'm
there for the meat, you know. I'm there. I want 8 inches thick, mm-hmm, of
all right,
cold,
okay,
cuts
that's
that
enough.
Have been. I want nothing friend. But lips and assholes.
This is where we end the podcast.
We have to go. Yeah, we have to go. Eric Silver is our producer. Brandon Google is our editor. Our theme song is by Kirk Hamilton. Ads and production services are by Multitude. And you can subscribe to Defector.com. All right, Defector, and hit that subscribe button. You can also email us at distraction@defector.com or even call us at 909-726-3720 and leave a message. That's 909-PANERA-0. And please go read Rohan over at Sports Illustrated. Support his work.
That's
actually the Aries. Everybody over there who's doing such a good job. And when Rohan comes on next, I will tell my story of how much Buffalo Wild Wings suck. We don't have time for that right now. We have to go. Rohan, you are the best in the biz. We love having you on.
Thanks, man.
Thank you, guys.
Bye.
Bye.